We are in the middle of a series about sticky questions that Christians wish no one would ask or hope no one would ask. It's really based on a book by Mark Middleberg, Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask with Answers. And if you haven't picked up a copy yet, there are more copies that are available in the back. The reason that we're doing this is because Scripture is very, very clear that we are to always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks us for the reason for the hope that we have. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks us for the reason for the hope that we have. Now, what we see from that passage is, number one, hopefully they're going to see that we have hope. And they're going to ask us the reason for that hope. The fact is that our world in and of itself, living on its own, is a hopeless place. And really the only source of hope is Jesus Christ. And if we as believers are living in the context of that hope, it's filling our lives, it's filling out our day, others are going to remark that. They're going to see that, and they're going to say, tell me about your hope. Now, to be quite honest, I've never had a person come up to me ever in my life and just say those words, tell me about your hope. But there has been an opportunity in the process of conversation, in the process of getting to know people, where it's really been able to develop in that direction, that we begin to talk about, well, where does your sense of hope come from? Where does your sense of meaning come from? Well, my sense of hope and meaning comes from this commitment that I have to the Lord Jesus Christ and my understanding that he came to save all of mankind and, in fact, to restore the world to the order that God intended, and that he's going to make all things new, and this is an incredible hope that we have, and he's willing to forgive all of us completely for our sins and our shortcomings and the way that we've rebelled against him. And so this hope is there. And what we need to be working on is being prepared to give an answer. So that's why it's not just a matter of listening to the sermon on a Sunday morning, but also digging deeper, reading literature, and preparing ourselves. One of the huge stumbling blocks for many people is the conviction that science and Christianity are at odds, especially in relationship to the science of evolution. The average person on the street, you talk to them, you walk up to them, streets of Seattle, they believe that Christianity and science collide. Even though science comes out of the Christian worldview that the created order is predictable and operates according to natural laws precisely because it was created. Science really arose, this study of natural laws and of the order in the world, it arose out of a Christian worldview that really does understand that, yeah, there's order, there's design there. But most people today think Christianity and science collide. What we contend as believers is that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament, the sky, that is, shows his handiwork. And that's the truth that we hold on to, but many, many people dispute that idea, and they feel like in order to be a Christian, we've somehow got to stick our head in the sand. Now, I'm especially concerned for our children, for our students, our young people growing up, because they're being taught a philosophical dogma of naturalism, and they often don't have any line of defense for it. Some of the arguments that are brought against Christians are downright vitriolic. So Richard Dawkins, for example, he states, It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane. Or wicked, he says in parentheses, but I don't want to go there. If you don't believe in evolution, he says, it's safe to assume that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane. That's the kind of messaging that our kids are hearing. And so we have to do whatever we can to equip them to be able to stand up against that vitriol. So how do we respond? Well, you've got some sermon notes in your bulletins, and I'd like you to pull those out and follow along. This message is going to have a little bit more content than some of them do. For some of you, it's going to feel like a science lesson. I don't think it is that, and I'm definitely not Bill Nye the Science Guy. I am not a scientist, although I'm fascinated by science and have read quite a bit along this line, but I don't pretend in any sense to be an expert. But I'm relying in this outline largely on what Middleburg covers in chapter 2 of this book. So the first point is this. We need to distinguish between microevolution and macroevolution. We've got to distinguish between microevolution and macroevolution. The reality of small adaptations in living organisms, what many call microevolution, is an observable fact. Originally, if you know a little bit about the story of the history of where the idea of natural selection came from, Charles Darwin was visiting the Galapagos Islands, and he was observing the finches there and the beaks, the varying sizes and dimensions of the beaks of this one species, and began to develop his theory of natural selection out of those observations. There are numerous examples of adaptation of species that science points to. Another example that Middleburg talks about is the peppered moths in Britain and how they adapt their coloring to their changing environment. I think all of you remember from science class the examination of the horse and the development of the horse in size. We recognize just through breeding, of course, how the changes can happen on a pretty dramatic scale. But much of the evidence for evolution that is actually concretely pointed to is actually a demonstration of the fact that microevolution happens. The large-scale change and development of every life form from an original bacteria, we don't have demonstrations of that. We don't have the gaps that are filled in the fossil record. The evidence simply doesn't demonstrate changes from one species to the other. I don't need to accept the argument that all life evolved from one original primitive form just because I accept the reality of small adaptations. So that's point number one. Point number two is a little bit more complex. It's three parts. There are at least three crucial building blocks that are necessary for evolution, but that evolution can't account for. Three crucial building blocks that are necessary for evolution, but evolution can't account for. The first is this: the existence of matter. Like Middleburg says in his book, matter matters. I do love the joke that's in the book, and I believe I'd heard it before. It's been around. About the scientists who came to the conclusion that we've just gotten so far along in our understanding and in our development of techniques and methodologies and that we just don't need God anymore. So one of the scientists was assigned to go to God and declare to him, you know, we don't need you. So that scientist goes to God and he says, you know what? We no longer need you. We've come a long way. We can clone people, do all sorts of wonderful things. And God says, well, okay, well, why don't we have a contest? Let's have a people-making contest. And the scientist says, okay, we're good for that. We're ready to go. And God says, well, we're going to do it like I did it originally, way back when, with Adam and Eve. And the scientist says, okay, no problem. And the scientist reaches down to grab a handful of dirt. And God says, no, wait a minute. You got to get your own dirt. The question of where matter comes from is a big deal. Now, cosmologists tell us that it began with a singularity, an infinitesimal dot that contained infinite mass and energy, and that dot flung the universe into being 13.7 billion years ago. They can clock it based on measurements, and the measurements become more and more sophisticated with newer technologies. Hubble telescope has given us incredible kind of insight. And so based on the expansion of the universe, the estimate at this point is 13.7 billion years. In fact, one of the great discoveries of the last century is the fact that our universe is expanding. The discovery came about originally as we are examining distant galaxies and began to note that there was a red shift, a Doppler effect difference in the light spectrum of the image that indicated that the galaxies were actually moving away from us. Doppler shift is like what we hear as a train goes by. It's going, ding, 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 as it's coming closer and closer, and then ding, 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 as it goes away. So what happens in the light shift is there's a shift toward red, which shows that these stars and galaxies are actually moving away from us. And in fact, the farther away they are, the more rapidly they're moving away. So Edwin Hubble, there's actually a law, Hubble's law, that was named after him. In the 1920s, he determined this fact that the further away the galaxies, the greater the redshift and the higher the velocity. In other words, the whole universe is expanding and moving away from each other. Thence came the theory that the universe at one point was all together, was an infinitesimal, you can't even say particle, a singularity where everything was packed into a dot so small you can't even measure it, and that it exploded into being 13.7 billion years ago. The thing is that it's possible to name an event without explaining how or why it happened. That's the case in this concept. We can name something, we can call it a Big Bang, we can describe that this expansion is taking place, we can even measure the expansion, but even physicists and mathematicians and cosmologists are stymied at the physics involved in the moments just before and just after the universe exploded into existence. They can't explain how, they can't explain why. In fact, you read some of the cosmology about the beginning of the universe, and it almost sounds spiritual. It sounds more spiritual than it sounds scientific. It actually sounds a lot like our holy scriptures that declare that, and simply state, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Bang. They were there. Big Bang. The second thing that evolution cannot explain is the origin of the first life forms. They cannot explain it. in order for evolution to work, you have to come up with first life form from which then other life forms evolve. Now, way back in 1953, the year I was born, Stanley Miller had a famous experiment that he did. He tried to reproduce the original conditions in which life supposedly evolved on the Earth. And so he brought together what was thought to be the primitive atmosphere, methane, ammonia, hydrogen, sulfide gases, brought those together, connected it to a flask where there was water representing the Earth's oceans, and then introduced sparks to represent lightning. And what he did end up with was what he called the building blocks of life. Now, he came up with amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks of life. He was able to reproduce amino acids. So, sugars, fatty acids, organic compounds. We can produce amino acids. The problem is when we set up an environment for their production, we always end up with 50% right-handed and 50% left-handed molecules. But for life, we only need the left-handed ones. Any compounds that end up being built end up being one-armed compounds. We've never been able to produce chains. And an added problem is that the polypeptides, which are necessary for life, what happens to them is they tend to break apart in water rather than holding together in water. There's so many things that work against building, actually, these building blocks of life, the amino acids, into actual life forms. Let's take one of the simplest proteins in the human body, which is hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a relatively simple protein. It consists of 146 amino acid chain. Now, given all the possibilities for amino acids, the possible combination of that 146 amino acid chain, possible combination, is 10 to the 190th power. That is an incredible number. The number of atomic particles in the universe is estimated at 10 to the 90th power. So there's these combinations of what could happen it's so incredibly large that the fact is that I think we have been brainwashed into believing that given enough time, sheer chance assures the existence of life. It simply does not. The odds are so stacked against life ever forming on its own that that a reasonable person says it just doesn't make sense. Now, I'm not saying that people who believe that it spontaneously came into being are unreasonable by nature, but they have to do twists of reason in order to get there. And we can talk more about that in the Q&A session that's going to take place at the end of the second service. If you'd like to stick around, if you're going to one of the classes and want to stick around at 12:20, we'll gather here and we'll have some Q&A, and that should be really fun. But one other thing that's crucial for the building block, a crucial building block that evolution can't account for, is the origin of information. Information. The key feature of life is information, say Dembski and McDowell, specified complexity. Even the most simple bacterial cells teem with vast amounts of information. A single primitive cell would require hundreds of thousands of bits of information precisely sequenced in its DNA. But in the entire history of the universe, given 13.7 billion years, given that amount of time, chance, mathematical chance, can only produce 400 bits of sequenced information. And that's what the math says. There's only a chance of 400 bits, but you need hundreds of thousands of bits to have even the simplest life form. Now, consider, for example, the amount of information that's contained in human DNA. The Human Genome Project, Francis Collins has written extensively about it, and he describes how that how this discovery, you know, how they began to unpack the human genome and these strands of DNA, and recognize that in every single cell of the human body, there's a strand 3 billion characters long. 3 billion characters, all written in its unique four-letter code. It's so complex that if you were to type it out on a normal font on a letter-sized paper, so you take your DNA, you type it out on normal letter size, normal font, and you print it out, that those pieces of paper stacked one on top of the other would be as high as the Washington Monument. That's the amount of information that's packed into the DNA of every single cell of your body. It's incredible. The evidence is so powerful that self-confessed atheists are changing course. And a few years ago, I read a book by Anthony Flew, who wrote one of the most compelling philosophical arguments for atheism in the 20th century. And he's repudiated his atheistic stance based on the evidence that DNA, the more we study it, the more complex we see it is, and we recognize it just can't spontaneously evolve. It just doesn't happen. So he writes, "What I think the DNA material has done is that it has shown, by the almost unbelievable complexity of the arrangements that are needed to produce life, that intelligence must have been involved in getting these extraordinarily diverse elements to work together." Intelligence must have been involved. Now, Anthony Flew is not saying necessarily that it's the Christian God, that it's Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he is saying, "I'm compelled by the logic of the evidence that intelligence needed to make this happen. It couldn't happen all on its own." So, matter matters. Life had to come about with bringing incredibly complex elements together, and the information needed to be packed in there for it to pass on from one to the other. And those things, evolution can't explain those things. Third point, the stumbling block to faith is not evolution, but philosophical naturalism. It's not evolution, but philosophical naturalism. It's one thing to say that science can only test for natural causes and cannot speak to any others. And that's true. Science, by its very nature, is looking for repeatable, observable information that I can repeat an experiment over and over again, and I can observe what's happening, and science works that way. It's careful observation. And science can only test for natural causes. It's one thing to say that's the limitation of science. It's quite another to insist that no other causes are possible. See, science is not incompatible with Christianity. Philosophical naturalism is. Good science doesn't make the claim that there can't be anything other than natural causes. Philosophical naturalism is the worldview, an arrogant one, that insists there are no other causes. For example, John Macquarie, a philosophical naturalist, says this: "Science proceeds on the assumption that whatever events occur in the world are accounted for in terms of other events. The concept of miracle is irreconcilable with our modern understanding of both science and history." So I think we're all kind of familiar with that attitude. The idea is that science has taken us beyond that. We don't need supernatural. We don't need to have supernatural explanations anymore. We've passed beyond that. We can explain everything with our natural mind. But to rule out other causes is actually an illogical step. Alvin Plantinga, who is a fantastic Christian philosopher and one of the sharpest minds today, and recently, a couple of years ago, he spoke down at UPC, a really, really great evening and of discussion and dialogue. But Plantinga says this. This argument, that is McQuire's argument, this argument is like the drunk who insisted on looking for his lost car keys only under the street light on the grounds that the light was better there. In fact, it would go the drunk one better. It would insist that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark, they must be under the light. In other words, to kind of unpack that little argument, basically, philosophical naturalists insist that because the only way they, the only source of truth that they accept is the scientific method, in other words, under the street light, then God must be accessible to the scientific method. He must be under the street light or he doesn't exist. But no one said God had to be under the streetlight. No one said he had to be accessible to the scientific method. And there are evidences for God's existence that go certainly, I mean, in science we see evidence, we see marks of God, you know, flung throughout the universe, but we don't have to subject him to the scientific method, and we don't have to, in our minds, say, oh, just because we can't prove God scientifically means he can't exist. That's illogical. If there is a creator who makes things out of nothing, it's only logical that we who were created by him would not be able to observe him or reproduce him in a lab. Now, the fourth point is actually, it's the so-called cosmological argument for God's existence. And it correlates with point 2a above, that matter matters. But I just wanted to unpack it a little bit to give you the logical syllogism. So the mere existence of the cosmos points to the existence of God. And here's the logical syllogism. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. Whatever begins to exist has to have a cause for its existence. Number two, the universe began to exist. So it's one of those things that began to exist, the universe. Number three, therefore, the universe must have a cause for its existence. Okay, that just simple logic. If something begins, it's got to have a cause. The universe began to exist, so the universe has to have a cause. The fourth thing, the attributes of the cause of the universe, for example, being outside of time, and having an infinite nature, in order to cause something like the universe, you've got to have the attributes of you have to have the attributes of God. Therefore, final point, the cause of the universe must be God, or something with the attributes of God, and the only thing that we know who has the attributes of God is God. The eternality, the timelessness, the all-powerful nature, the only thing that really explains the beginning, the cause of the universe, is a cause who is God himself. The other option is to assume that matter is eternal, and energy is eternal. But even then you have to explain, okay, how is it then that this eternal energy and eternal matter burst into the reality that we know at a point 13.7 billion years ago? So this is the so-called cosmological argument. It's not going to completely bowl someone over and say, oh yeah, I have to believe in God because there had to be a cause for the universe. What happens is that we recognize that people are able to just kind of set that aside. In fact, a lot of people simply say, well, the universe is there. And so it has to exist, but I don't have to come up with a cause for its existence. I don't need to think there or go there in my thinking. Now, the fifth thing, and what I'd like to close with, is that there are three different Christian views of creation. And I think we need to understand this and recognize this. There's young earth creationism, and young earth creationism basically asserts that the description in Genesis 1 and 2 are very literal, that the earth was created in 6 literal days only a few thousand years ago. Usually it's estimated somewhere between 8 and 12,000 years ago that the world came into existence at God's hand. Old earth creationism is the second idea, and that's that the earth was created over an unspecified time frame in the logical order that is given to us in Genesis. This view is based on part on the fact that the Hebrew word for day, yom, has a very broad reach. It can be interpreted similarly to the way we use the word day. So we talk about in Abraham's day, it was common for people to have more than one wife. Well, we're not talking about a day, we're talking about in that time frame. The way we use day is quite broad, and the way that the Hebrews used yom is quite broad. It can refer to a particular day, it can refer to an age. And so this view of old earth creationism basically says it happened over a period of time, a period of ages, and we don't need to identify specifically how long those periods of time were. So the passages in Genesis 1 and 2 are understood as representations of what God did in history, but they have a poetic form. So a person of that persuasion says, I believe that God used some combination of supernatural intervention and providential guidance to construct the universe. So he's intervening and he's providentially guiding the construction of the universe, but it's happening over an extended period of time. The third option is theistic evolution, or what is sometimes called fully gifted creation. According to this view, the passages don't represent history, but they demonstrate theology. So the fall of man is a real theological construct. That we're created in the image of God is a genuine theological construct. But how God worked to bring us into being is that he was active behind the scenes, superintending the evolutionary process. So Genesis 1 and 2 is interpreted poetically. So a person of this persuasion says, I believe that God has so generously gifted the creation for self-organization and transformation that an unbroken line of evolutionary development from non-living matter to the full array of existing life forms is not only possible, but in fact has taken place. So God, he packed all of this possibility into the world he created and then let it evolve. Now, what I want to plead for is this. Every one of those views has its difficulties. What we need to do is not make a conversion away from belief in evolution the prerequisite for a conversion to Christ. We don't have to convince people, our friends who are not yet believers, we don't have to convince them that evolution is wrong in order to bring them to a conviction that Jesus Christ is the Lord of the universe. It's not necessary. There are many Christians who actually believe in evolution. I do not, that's not my conviction. I believe in the active creative hand of God in every stage of the world coming into existence. But some believe that God set this path in motion, and they're sincere believers just like I am. I think what we do need to plead for is this. Let's respond with gentleness and graciousness to those who have different views. Romans 14, starting at verse 1 and going through the whole chapter, says, "Let us accept other believers and not argue with them about what they think is right or wrong. Let us aim for harmony in the church and try to build each other up." There's a famous saying of the Moravian church that's been often quoted, and it goes like this: "In essentials, unity; in non-essentials, liberty; in all things, charity." In relationship to this evolutionary question, is it important that we have understandings? Absolutely. Is it important that we have some ammunition, or that we have reasons for the hope that we have? Absolutely. Are there reasons to call the evolution into process? Absolutely. Is there a reason to call philosophical naturalism into question? Yes, compellingly. And I think that's the main and principal issue. So let's equip ourselves, but let's in these matters hold on to an attitude and a heart of charity. So you have on the back of your forms, the back of your notes, and also on the connection cards that Pastor Scott mentioned. On those connection cards are some takeaways. Let me suggest four different things, well, three different things, and then for your own. Let me suggest some possible takeaways from this morning's message. Number one, why don't you work really hard this week to engage someone in the conversation of where they think the cosmos came from? Just ask them that question. What do you think caused the cosmos? And let the conversation go and develop, and you can talk about how you see the cause of the cosmos. A second thing, and I think this is a great one and I'd highly recommend it, take a walk at night sometime this week and intentionally consider the heavens. Just watch and look at the stars and reflect. Psalm 8, 3 to 4 says, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him?" The creation is shot through with the glory of God, and sometimes we just need to just drink it in. A third thing is pick up the book and read it or reread it. Read chapter 2 and drink in I would say drink in scripture. This is more like read it carefully and try to absorb the arguments that are there. Or fill in your own takeaway. I would love to read what your takeaways are. But another thing is that I'd love you to write down a question for the Q&A at the end of the... If you're going to stick around, and I'd love to see you stick around, write down a question that you'd like to discuss. And Keith Elder and I are going to be here at about 12:20, and we're just going to have about 20 minutes of Q&A, just as long as you want to go. Not a long time, but just talking about some of these issues. And I'm not saying that we'll have all the answers, but it can be a fruitful and positive dialogue. In closing, we're going to be singing a song, and I love this song. It's Phil Wickham, and it's called Beautiful. And it starts out, I see your face in every sunrise. Color of the morning is inside your eyes. It's this whole picture that we really do see God's glory writ large across the firmament. And this particular song, there's a time-lapse photography piece that's been done that shows some incredible pictures of God's handiwork, especially in the skies. And so as the ushers come forward and prepare to collect your cards, which we take very seriously, and we pray for your prayer requests, and I pray over your responses that you're going to make. So I'd love reading them. Please put them in. Let's contemplate the incredible glory of God as we sing the song together.